and all prisoners, but in particular, political prisoners who are still being held in prison and those who were killed in prison. Now, Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the longest standing political prisoners, he called Black August, quote, a month of injustice and divine justice, of repression and righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slave and break the chains that bind us. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our assistant producer, Alicia Vargas. I'd like to thank our board engineer, Gary Baca, to welcome our board engineer in training, Z. Orozco. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, Sojourner Truth. We'll be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening, and you all please stay well and safe.
Some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s, standing on your head. Yow!
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it. Welcome back to Roe on the Rocks. Last time on this show, I spoke with David Donati with the ACLU of Texas and Kathy Torres with the Frontera Fund about who is most impacted by Texas's Senate Bill 8 law. Today, I'm speaking with Tamaya Cox Torre, the executive director of the ACLU of Oklahoma. Back in March, I spoke with Tamaya about Oklahoma's abortion ban that was passed and signed into law before Roe was even overturned. But first, here's some background on what abortion access actually looked like in Oklahoma over the past several years.
So Oklahoma is no stranger to harsh restrictions of abortion. We have been, the Oklahoma legislature for several years, decades, has been on the forefront of passing very restrictive anti-abortion laws. So that's nothing new. At the same time, we've been very fortunate that we've been able to curb some of the most harshest abortion restriction laws that have been passed by filing lawsuits against them. However, there are still several restrictions of abortion access and abortion care in our state. I think what's really important to know is that Oklahoma is really important to the abortion access landscape right now, because we are seeing so many patients from Texas coming to Oklahoma to get the care that they need and deserve. However, that again puts strain on our providers. In Oklahoma, our providers, probably not too different than a lot of states, our providers are simply just in our urban areas. So Tulsa and Oklahoma City are two largest cities. And that's where our providers are. So a lot of Oklahomans have kind of lived in this post-Roe era, I would say, because abortion access is so far away. But I think just really important to know is that we continue to pass very restrictive laws, but organizations like ACLU of Oklahoma, Planned Parenthood, OCRJ, our reproductive justice organization, continues to fight just as hard to ensure that abortion access is available to all who need and want it.
When you say that for Oklahomans, that abortion is so far away, do you mean that the geographical landscape, that clinics and facilities that provide abortion services are not nearby to most residents? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I would say that. Rural Oklahomans do not have a provider, very near to them, so they must travel. As well as, I would also say that abortion access is expensive, right? Like, trying to get an abortion is expensive. So it is, we have laws that have recently, and when I say recently, within the last 10 plus years, that have prohibited abortions to be covered within insurance policies, some restrictions on abortions in those that have Medicaid or government-ran health insurance. So I definitely geographical, but I think as well as accessible, just in the sense that sometimes it's really expensive for people to access, basic health care, which we think abortion care is.
And can you talk about some of those barriers or restrictions that you're talking about? So I know that you're mentioning the insurance, and I know from my own research there are other barriers that are very common in other states that have trigger law bans, like 24-hour, no, actually you have 72-hour, I believe, waiting period, and then other state mandates. Can you get into the nitty-gritty of what those are?
For sure. So we have, unfortunately, a whole host of them. So they run from, we now require people seeking an abortion to wait 72 hours. We have restrictions on who can perform an abortion. So it must be a doctor in a specialized hospital, so very heavily regulated by our Department of Health. We also have restrictions that we require patients to fill out a very lengthy, I think it's like 38 pages of a questionnaire that patients must be required to fill out and submit. Doctors also have to, just the regulations of the doctors going through the informed consent papers that they are required to give to patients as well as that they're required to submit. And then we also have just, thankfully, some of these are temporarily enjoined, but we have laws that would try to regulate how to access the abortion pill, so medication abortion. Those are just a little bit of the laws we have that continue to make abortion access less accessible to Oklahomans.
And when you said earlier that in Oklahoma, residents have already had to get used to that you're living essentially in a post-Roe state. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about in terms of these barriers? And how long have these regulations been in place?
Correct. So what I mean by a lot of Oklahomans have lived in a post-Roe because just abortion access has not been readily available to them. So many of these laws, we really saw a increase of abortion restrictions passed into law, I would say about 2009. I think very much the national trend in 2010 was just the sheer amount of abortion laws that were signed into law by conservative legislatures. Oklahoma was no different. So 2009 starting from 2009 all the way until now is when we've seen the largest increase of abortion access, or excuse me, abortion restrictions being passed at our legislature. And while I said earlier that many of them that had the most impact have been struck down as unconstitutional by the court, we also have to think about what the impact looks like in communities. When we see bills that are talked about in the media, some people automatically, because they may not be familiar with the process, the legislative process, think that a bill is law, right? Like, they may think like the bill that they heard passed out of one of our chambers is now current law, or they may not be aware that a bill that was signed into law was struck down by our state Supreme Court, you know, a couple years later or months later. So that's really what I mean, is that the information could be, sometimes the information or lack of information can be a barrier to Oklahomans accessing abortion care.
So you might be wondering, how do Oklahomans actually feel about abortion? Well, according to a Pew Research poll conducted back in 2014, 51% of Oklahomans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, whereas 45% say abortion should be illegal in all or most cases.
We actually recently did a study, a poll, that showed that the majority of Oklahomans, and I will make sure to provide this information to you later, the majority of Oklahomans actually don't want to see Roe v. Wade overturned, or at least want some type of abortion access to be, some type of an abortion access to be available. But what we also know is that, yes, while legislators are elected officials by the people, that doesn't mean that they get to legislate the rights, even if those are minority voices. So even if they are just saying that, you know, this is what my constituents want, it is unlikely, because we just know that that's just not the case sometimes. But more importantly, we know that the will of the people does not get to negate the rights of minorities and the minority's views. And I think that's just a really important part of it. However, what we hear time and time and time again is that constituents want legislators that are going to push legislation that moves Oklahoma forward. Constituents want legislators that are really going to focus on the needs of Oklahomans. And this is not, you know, typically not the top three needs or wants of Oklahomans when they're knocking on doors. And you can hear legislators after legislator talk about what are the concerns of Oklahomans, and abortions and the right to abortion tends to not be on the forefront of people's minds every day.
What is on the forefront of Oklahomans' minds?
Yep. So I think it's access to strong education is what a lot of Oklahomans, access to important and much needed health care, so comprehensive health care, and then ensuring that the economy in Oklahoma is strong, so people have jobs. Those are what we hear when we conduct exit polls, and when we conduct any type of polling, is what are on the minds and forefront of Oklahomans.
Now, here's what the legal landscape looked like back in March, just months before the state of Oklahoma passed a law completely banning abortion.
So currently, Oklahoma has a trigger law, meaning that if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned in June, that automatically abortion access would be illegal in Oklahoma. And I think what's important to know is that a lot of states, what we've seen, including Oklahoma, did not want to go through a judicial process to revive some of our pre-Roe laws that are still on the books. So by creating this trigger law, this kind of bypasses that. But what I would also say is that in the midst of all of that, creating this trigger law, they eroded or erased a lot of the abortion restriction laws that they've passed in the last couple years. So a new trigger law that is, goes further, that just says that, you know, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, then abortion access and restrictions, abortion access will be illegal. However, they want to keep all the abortion restriction laws on the books. They don't want to erase all the abortion restriction laws that they placed on. So that's one of them. However, what we are seeing in Oklahoma is we have at least two copycats of the Texas law, of Senate Bill 8. So specifically taking abortion access and not criminalizing it, but making it a civil action. Our current Oklahoma bills that are making its way through the process would prohibit abortions at conception, which is different than Texas. They have a 6-week period or a 6-week ban. Ours would be at conception, so it goes further. And then it would state that if an abortion happens, quote unquote, after conception, then there's a private right to action for any Oklahoman, even if they don't have a relationship or anything with the patient who received the abortion.
And for each one, you're saying private right to action. Does that mean in both 1503 and HB 4327, a private citizen can sue and profit off of suing someone?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. That would allow for private citizens to bring in a civil action against abortion provider, as well as anyone who aids and abets someone to get an abortion. So that is what the fear is, because in neither one of these bills is there a good, I think, clarification of what AIDS could mean. So we have an abortion fund. So people who give to the abortion fund, knowing that these bills, that their donation is going to, help someone access abortion, does that violate these rules? You know, organizations like the one I belong to, Oklahoma Call for Reproductive Justice, that puts out a magazine. Now, is that part of, is that in violation? Unfortunately, we do not have clear guidance on that, but that's the other part of it that we may not be talking about as much, is that, yes, it goes against private abortion providers, but there is a caveat about those who aid and help someone access an abortion.
I'm wondering, I know I'm asking questions that, are very broad, but is there anything in our healthcare system that you know of that a private citizen can file a civil lawsuit and profit off of, and it's not for something like damages where a surgery, there's malpractice of some sort? Is there anything in the healthcare system where a private citizen can profit off of it just for simply a person accessing a form of healthcare?
Great question, and the answer is simply no. And in nowhere do we and no other issue do we have kind of this private right to action allowed when there's not a direct link or a direct relationship with the person that they are suing, if that makes sense. And so what this potentially could open the door to is so many other social justice fights, like gay marriage, even potentially some gun laws, right? We consider these fundamental rights. We consider an abortion, access to an abortion, a fundamental right. Are there other fundamental rights that could be decreased or interfered with through the civil right of action? And that's what I think everyone, regardless of how they feel about this issue, should and could be concerned about.
Just kind of wrapping up with the different bills or the trigger law, how do all of those work independently and together? Meaning, let's say Roe is overturned with Mississippi's case, which of these or how many of these could become enforced? How does that all layer out? Because you have ones that ban abortion at conception at 30 days after a menstrual cycle, and then the trigger law ban. Right. Which supersedes what?
Yeah. So, I think that's a great question that we continue to work with our legal experts on this. If, depending on the June case, I say regardless of the June case, because of the way Oklahoma will play out, is that our session ends the end of May. So our session ends the end of May. Therefore, many of these laws or some of these laws will have either been signed into law or will be signed into law and going into effect before most likely in June when the Mississippi case comes down. If Roe v. Wade to be overturned, I think it's just really important to know is that it would, you know, Roe v. Wade wouldn't outlaw abortion. It would simply bring back that right to the states, so states can make the decisions. So that is what I think what's important is that whatever happens on a federal level, if Roe v. Wade is overturned or severely diminished on the federal level, most likely it won't have any effect in Oklahoma because of we would have already passed these laws and they may have already been into effect. But on the flip side, and if we can be very optimistic, if the Supreme Court upholds Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey in some way, or simply chooses just to say that the 15-week ban is permissible, but only that, like we're only, like the Supreme Court could not overturn Roe v. Wade, could overturn Roe v. Wade, or could simply rule on the facts of the Mississippi case, then it is very possible we have more legal protection to go to enjoin or challenge these laws that could go into a place, if that makes sense, right?
That's interesting. So, okay.
I guess in short to say is only if Roe v. Wade is severely diminished or overturned on the federal level, little impact in Oklahoma because these laws are going to affect. However, if Roe v. Wade stays in place as it is, then we have a better argument and better fight to challenge these bills so they don't become effective and go into law.
Just playing devil's advocate and not to diminish your optimism of your organization. How, in what ways is that true if Roe is upheld, at least the weeks part? How is that true given what we've already seen with Texas?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of that law continues to be legal, very much so because the legislators crafted it so that the government is not this. It's not a state act carrying out this law. It's private citizens.
For sure. So what I think I would say, and I will say some of this is coming with like research that we're doing, is that one thing that has been lost of all of this is that specifically, the private right to action was allowed to go through in Texas because they simply said that the court clerks in Texas, you know, they were simply administrative in their actions, and they did not make authority or have authority or enforce the actions. They didn't have court clerks didn't have the power to enforce these actions. They were simply administrative, and I know this kind of gets in the weeds. Mm-hmm. That may not be the case for Oklahoma. Oklahoma's court clerks may actually have more authority and more enforcement power than Texas's court clerks. Therefore, they may play a bigger role in these private right to actions. Therefore, it may not be the same. It may not be the same facts as in Texas, which could mean that we don't necessarily have the same outcome.
Just putting that in simpler terms, meaning that in Oklahoma, the clerk would, there would be more of a state influence in terms of enforcing this. Am I getting that right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's, like, there would be more of a state interference.
Got it.
Just by the role of court clerks in Oklahoma. I think the other thing to also mention is that Oklahoma, since the early 2000s, we've actually been challenging our lawsuits in state court as opposed to federal court. So it is very possible that our state court could have more, may understand our state court clerk process better or have better ties. So again, these feel like sometimes long shots, but it's important to know that states are different. And so we don't necessarily have the same facts in Texas, or here in Oklahoma, as though we're in Texas, which could make us have, like I said, a different outcome. So that's where my optimism comes from, as well as just, like, it's so hard to truly think that abortion access could be gone in Oklahoma, you know, as early as May. So.
No, but thank you for explaining that. That's a really good point that obviously I didn't acknowledge or know that states are different and they operate differently. So
they operate different.
Yeah. So absolutely. So just wrapping up, I want to ask you, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you would like to, or anything that listeners should know about what's going on in Oklahoma? Yeah.
One of the things, I think, just lastly, from a very just kind of top level view, is that when we talk about abortion bans here in Oklahoma, we really talk about the impact that these have on our Black and Brown communities, our Native communities, and even more, we talk about the need to be more inclusive in our language, because we know that the trans Oklahomans also get abortions. And so we know, and we talk about, like, we can talk about, like, these abortion policies all day, and the good, the bad, the ugly of it all. But until we get back to, people deserve to make basic healthcare decisions for themselves. And what we do know is that politicians have to stay out of these exam rooms.
This is Claire Rosciotto with KBFM, and you're listening to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America while Roe was still the law of the land. Music in this episode is Ragtime by Peerless, courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Tune in next Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear more.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.